Welcome to Endeavors. Kick it, boys. Good afternoon, Radioland, and welcome to Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, up atop Simon Fraser University. It's a beautiful April afternoon, nice and warm. Finally, the rain is gone, the sunshine is out, so get out there and enjoy yourselves, or stay in and listen to us, because we're going viral today, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, we've got poet, improviser, and viral video sensation, Jesse Perron, all the way from Utah. You may have seen his video, "To the Boys Who One Day May Date My Daughter." He talks about that, where the inspiration came from, and how, when he knew that his poem was going to be the next big thing. Also, on the other side of things, we have, from Los Angeles, documentary photographer Isadora Kosofsky. Recently, the Huffington Post republished one of her stories entitled "The Three," which is a love triangle involving senior citizens. Very interesting. She also has some other projects out there as well that we'll be talking to her. And the music today, I'm super thrilled. Canadian icon Jimmy Rankin is on the show today. He's got a new album out, Back Road Paradise. We're going to start for you with a track off said album, Back Road Paradise. And this is this is actually his song, Flames. And this one features Alison Krauss. And this is Jimmy Rankin, Back Road Paradise.
Damn your beautiful face, damn your beautiful eyes, they'll be the end of me. Hell is a long, long drive under a rusted sky, nothing around for miles. There's a highway sign that has no business in, all your sins will be forgiven, amen. Glimpse of heaven, I may never get this close again. Damn your beautiful face. Love, love, it spills like wine, it leaves a terrible stain on this heart of mine. There's fire, it's only a matter of time till it all goes down in flames. Up ahead, a storm is coming. I've been throwing caution to the wind. Tonight I hold the peace of heaven. I may never get this chance again. Damn your beautiful face. There's a highway sign that has no business in all your it's only a matter of time till we all go down in flames.
Flames by Jimmy Rankin, featuring the great Alison Krauss. Jimmy, of course, for many years performed with his siblings, Heather, Cookie, Raylene, and John Morris, as part of the legendary The Rankin Family. He's now released 6 solo albums, the newest of which was Back Road Paradise. And you'll be hearing from Jimmy a little later on in the program. But right now, we have improviser, poet, and new viral video sensation, Jesse Perron, all the way from Utah. And I spoke to him on the phone about a week and a half ago about his newfound fame. On the phone with me now is improviser, poet, nerd, and viral video sensation, Jesse Perron. Jesse, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me.
So you're obviously the man behind to the boys who one day date my daughter.
Yes.
When did you first realize that this had exploded?
I think it was when Upworthy started talking to me about posting the video, and Adam Mordecai, who was the guy who wrote the video up, said, you know, you should really turn off your phone settings on Twitter. You're probably going to have it blow up. As soon as my brother, who's a big Tea Party guy, forwarded me that it had landed on one of his favorite conservative websites, I knew that it was probably going to go around. Go ahead.
So, what's that like for you? You're just, you know, seeming this average, you know, slam poet and improviser from Utah, and then suddenly you're everywhere all around the world. Here you are doing an interview with a Canadian.
But my last name is Perron. I love Canada.
Yeah.
it's wild. Honestly, my wife is pretty amused by it. She keeps on telling me like how many hits. I'm like, oh, okay. It's for me, it's a lot of fun because, the whole purpose behind slam poetry is to kind of trick people into listening to poetry. So, yeah. You know, mission accomplished. So I enjoy that aspect of it. What's really, you know, there's pluses and minuses. I really enjoy hearing people's stories and folks who tell me about their fathers or their mothers and send me really wonderful personal messages. On the flip side of that, you know, because it is sort of everywhere, it's on websites where when you have true anonymity, you start to see some really foul comments come up. You know, I'll get everything from a range of people who think that the violence is serious, and so they harp on that, or people who don't appreciate the end of the poem, referring to the fact that I'm okay with if my daughter is gay. And then people in the middle who take it as a challenge to kind of come at me, bro, or who want to now like actively have sex with my daughter, and I'm like, she's 12.
you mentioned that your brother's a Tea Partier, and sort of given the theme for your poem and your supposed political leanings, what was it like for you having it turn up on this conservative website? That must have been a little strange.
I'm a moderate. I'm nominally libertarian, but you know, I'm probably more left than that. To me, it was intriguing because you don't want art to be politicized. You don't want art to lean one way or the other. So if a conservative right wing, you know, website picks it up and says, "Hey, look at this expression of love." I mean, that's very human. That's what we should be doing. We shouldn't be saying, like, oh, conservatives shouldn't like this. We should say, hey, look, this love is universal and everybody gets it.
What I find interesting to me is that, you know, as a Canadian, I guess I don't understand the political atmosphere down there in regards to sort of how women are being portrayed in the media and their sexuality. The Fox News is always saying, oh, you know, the war on women. How do you think your poem fits into that landscape at all?
I think what folks will take away from it, you know, are a few different things. There's the folks that, like me, who are parents, who say, hey, look, you know, this is a very visceral, primal feeling to protect our daughters. And that's universal. Then there's the people who kind of get the satire, who say, hey, look, this is actually a send up of this trope. This is meant to make fun of it a little bit so that you can get at this other angle, which is love and universal acceptance. So if I can have people who straddle, you know, moderates like myself who really aren't extremists on either side, just watch this and get some sort of message of love and appreciation of this art form, I'm very okay with that.
How do you think the reaction would have been if it was about to the girls who one day date my son?
I think that would have been a great reaction. I get a lot of people who are saying, well, where's this poem? And I said, you know what, I'm actually been working on that for a couple of years. I just haven't figured out the angle yet. What I try to tell people is, hey, look, the pronouns are really flexible in this poem. I have a lot of moms who are messaging me saying, this is exactly how I feel about my sons. And I'm like, bravo, amen, go get them. So I think that from a more, you know, patriarchal masculine standpoint, it's hard to do that poem to say, you know, to the girls who may one day date my son. When I have real conversations with my kids that are not just 3-minute slam poems, which is my everyday interaction with them, I do talk to them about how to respect themselves and how to respect other people. And, you know, it's not just, you know, guys don't hit girls, it's don't hit anybody. But I was definitely raised by my dad to say, hey, look, no matter what, you never hit a woman.
Yeah.
And I've seen my brother get into bad relationships where, like, he was definitely physically abused by a woman, and it took him a lot to step away from that, because he had to say, hey, look, this isn't just about you don't hit a woman, this is about getting out of an abusive relationship.
Yeah. Do you remember, for you, where this seed for this performance poem came from?
I absolutely do. When I was in college, a friend of mine in my fraternity had a daughter, and there are a few of us that were, you know, the kids on the grant kind of guys, and he would talk about, you know, my daughter starts dating, I'm gonna be in the kitchen with my shirt off, tattoos showing, my boa constrictor around my neck, cleaning my guns, and if the kid says cool, he's out of there. And I always laughed at that. I always thought about that. It sort of stuck with me. And when I had a daughter, and I thought about that sort of primal feeling, I said to myself, well, yeah, but what if she doesn't date boys, she dates girls? And so I sort of wrote the whole poem around the last two lines, of just building up this, you know, big macho persona that descends into, hey, look, I know that this isn't realistic. I need you to love her. And then the last two lines are really where I think the big reveal of the piece is. And that's just to say, hey, look, this could be, don't just think about this in this narrow hallway. Think about this in a bigger sense.
Now, I'm interested in your background. I know you got into poetry sort of through your improv work.
Yes. Go ahead.
How would you say that slam poetry and improv are similar to each other?
Well, I think they're both highly theatrical. I mean, at least the way that I approach them. To me, a good slam poem is just as good as any improvised monologue or any theatrical monologue. And that's how I approached it at first. And, you know, there's a lot of people that I would call, you know, definitely real poets in the scene, you know, like Rachel McKibben, Alvin Lau, Vinez Smith, Denise Froman, those people who really, like, work at craft from the poetry lyrical angle. I work at it from the narrative performance angle. And so to me, I think any improviser could come into slam poetry with a good sense of, you know, three-act structures and pattern work and really do well. But I think that, the you know, when I look around and I see the folks that I call, like, true poets, you know, that their writing craft is just so far above mine, and I really respect and strive for, they're the ones who really showcase the art aspect of it and make it more than just about performance.
Do you think you'll bring Joker and Jester to Canada anytime soon?
You know, we keep being asked to. Vancouver Improv Festival is one of some of my favorite people. The Vancouver Poetry Slam scene is amazing.
Oh.
Yeah, Lisa Stewart, Duncan Phillips. I mean, honestly, there's just a lot of amazing folks in there that I love. And, you know, the improv scene, Taz, Van Russell, just really brilliant people. And I love that sense of humor. So I actually made a... New Year's resolution a couple of years ago to get my passport renewed just because I've been asked so many times by Vancouver folks to come up. And Joker is on my Poetry Slam team this year.
Nice.
Yeah, he's an amazing and funny poet. And so we're trying to figure out ways to use our style of improv in our style of poetry too and create group pieces. So we're working on some stuff right now that uses a lot of the physical and movement work that we like to do in our improv.
And I know in your day life you work in software and in communications as the director of quality insurance. How do your computer nerd friends respond to your double life?
You know, I get a lot of, like, especially right now I'm getting a lot of teasing about it. The funniest part was the first year I took second at the individual World Poetry Slam, I came back and my boss was like, "Well, how'd you do?" And I said, "Well, I took second." He goes, "Really?" And so he started throwing all of these like PowerPoints and was like, "You need to help me work with the language on this." I'm like, "Oh, gosh." So, you know, to me, I'm already kind of like a misfit. I'm in Utah. I'm a former, you know, I'm a child of tattoo artists and, you know, former tattoo artists who came from Massachusetts, so I kind of stick out anyway. But I have a lot of fun with work, and people really, I think in software especially, people understand and appreciate folks who get work done and produce results, and they become a lot more accepting even when they might come from a conservative background. So I really just had nothing but support and love from my coworkers. And what's wonderful for me is I work, you know, at a company that services the deaf, so we were able to get the videos captioned so that I could share them with my deaf friends, and I was really happy about that.
On that note, you know, both improv and Poetry Slam are very theatrical. Have you done in the past or thought about using that as a way to perform for your deaf friends? And if so, how would that work, do you think?
You know, I have some poems that incorporate sign language. I'm just really terrible at sign language, and I've tried for 8 years to learn it, and I have very patient deaf friends who nod and don't teach me the wrong words. What I love about watching interpreters is they're very evocative of emotion. They're very expressive, and so when I talk, I talk with my hands a lot, and I'll get comments from interpreters. They're like, "You should try this," and I'm like, "Yeah, you know, but I'm not smart enough to do what you do. I have this brain, not that brain." I wonder at it, but I would love to be able to incorporate more sign into my work. And I do, I use a lot of classifiers, for example, from sign language whenever I do performances. So I learned quite a bit about how to represent shape, how to represent size,
yeah,
from sign language. That's wonderful for me. And I do have one poem that I do called Deaf and Dumb, which is about comparing how deaf people understand noise like white people understand racism. You know, they know it exists, but they don't really, they've never really experienced it, so they don't really get the full magnitude of it. But that's about as far as I've gone. I haven't done things like Reeves, who talks about, you know, being a sign language instructor, or Joaquin Zuanzaneo, who has a similar poem that deals with the same aspects. And performance-based sign language is beautiful. It's like dance. If you've ever seen folks who just do sign language for singers or poets, their movements are so fluid and beautiful. Mona Jean from L.A. is one of our go-to interpreters for big national poetry events, and she's just beautiful to watch.
Given, sort of going back to the poem here, given that your daughter is 12 and she's getting at that age where, you know, she may discover that she wants to be more than friends with people. What do you fear most as a parent, and what do you hope for as a parent?
I think what I fear most as a parent is, you know, just your usual heartbreak that she'll take something too seriously, or that, you know, she'll have all the emotions that you and I had when we were that age, where, you know, we think we know what love is, and you know, you make bad decisions because of it. What I hope for is that she finds somebody that she is her friend, and that she understands that love and friendship are essential partners, and that it isn't just about these big puppy dog romance feelings, but it's really about a solid relationship. And, you know, I hope that comes across with my wife, because my wife was my best friend before we ever started dating. In fact, I thought she was way out of my league, and that's why I ever thought she could be a potential wife.
Yeah.
But we were just, you know, we were just really great friends, and we fall back on that. I mean, I'll be old and saggy one day, and, you know, we're going to have to deal with the fact that we mentally get along with each other.
What does your daughter think of your poem?
She says, "Oh, I'm famous." She likes it. She has a good time with it. She likes some of my other poems better, like the Girl Scout cookie poem that I do. But she likes that poem and tries to do it along with me sometimes. My favorite line is always, you know, at the end, she'll go, "Well, thanks, Dad. I really like that poem, but you know, I'm not gay." And I'm like, "Yeah, I love you anyway. That's all right." You know, she knows who she is, and she knows what she wants. And I actually love talking about that poem with her, because I'm like, "Well, what do you think this is about?" And she's like, "Well, you know, I think ultimately it's about making fun of these big, you know, like, you know, being a tough guy, a bad dad, but like, it's all about love, Dad." I'm like, "Well, you know what? I wish that half the internet was as smart as my 12-year-old daughter."
Yeah. Well, if you haven't seen the video, you should check it out. It's on Upworthy's site, and it's probably on YouTube and a million other sites by now. You can visit Jesse Perron at jester.net and follow him on all the usual social media aspects. Jesse Perron, thanks so much for your time today.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
All right, cheers. Have a good one.
You too. Bye-bye.
And that was Jesse Perron. And just in case you haven't yet heard the poem, we've got it here for you. This is "To the Boys Who May One Day Date My Daughter" by Jesse Perron.
To the boys who may one day date my daughter. I have been waiting for you. Since before her birth, since before my spark took hold and ignited the fire in her mother's belly, I have been training to kill you. When you took your first steps, I was preparing to make it so you never walked again. When you played at war, I was perfecting headshots. You can't catch up at this point. And when you first meet my daughter and fall in love with the look she sends over her shoulder, her crescent moon eyes framing her laughing smile, you are gonna wanna talk to her. And when those hours pass by like sprinters during that first timeless conversation, you will also know, with a deep and impending sense of dread, that you are going to have to talk to me when you first come to my home and see the bone carving over my threshold. Try not to imagine your own femurs so expertly carved. Pay no attention to my ample crawl space, my room with the rubber mat and a drain. Be careful to only approach me with love for my daughter. See, I have been seeding her childhood with taproot hugs to weed out indifference and apathy. There will be no daddy issues for your teenage talons to latch upon. If you break her heart, I will hear it snap with the ear I pressed against her mother's belly, the elbow I cradled her head in will send a message to my fists. My cheeks are attuned to her lips. I will know if they tremble. I have taught her that a man should never hit a woman. Now, her mother would like to add that she really shouldn't ever hit anybody, but I have taught her that a man should never hit a woman. Consider my genes a mark of Cain. You will suffer 7 times whatever you do to her, and she will not keep your secret. You can't make fire feel afraid. I have been teaching her love all of her life, and all that I ask is that you continue the lesson. Love her Befriend her, protect her, be there when I can't, and when my body gives up to the grave, let the grin that eternity carves into my face be a reflection of the peace that your love brings to her. And we should get along just fine. Addendum. To the girls who may one day date my daughter. My wife is a better shot than I am.
And that was Jesse Parent with To the Boys who May One Day Date My Daughter. And once again, you can visit him at jester.com. Okay, we have a couple of announcements, and then we have another song from Mr. Jimmy Rankin. Now, this is a song from Jimmy Rankin off his album Back Road Paradise. This is his single, Cool Car.
I got a cool car, girl I just met. Miles of open road, places we ain't been yet. Petty on the radio, full tank to burn. And I got a feeling, this night's gonna take a turn. So come a little closer, put your head on my shoulder. Just me and you, get lost somewhere. Come out, yeah, the top comes down. And the wheels are chrome, it's got leather seats, and it sure feels good. You're sitting next to me. So come a little closer, put your head. Open road and places we ain't been yet. Come a little closer, put your head on my shoulder. Just me and you, get lost somewhere. If we end up in Colorado, some tell me we don't know, baby. I don't care. If we end up in Arizona,
Jimmy Rankin, Cool Car, Back Road Paradise. And I spoke with the Canadian icon himself on Friday when he was in town for his show, at Shadbolt. This is my chat with Jimmy Rankin. Jimmy Rankin. Jimmy, hello, welcome.
Hello.
The new album is Back Road Paradise. The origin of this album for you, where would you say it came from?
Well, it's a country record, my kind of country, the country record I would make. I wouldn't say a generic country record for sure, but it's been a progression. I've been sort of dabbling in country music my entire life, even with my siblings, the Rankins. We would do country music from time to time on a record. And, my previous record, which was called Forget About the World, I started experimenting more with traditional country instruments like pedal steel and dobro and mandolin. So this record, I just decided to make a full-on country record that I could deliver singles to radio and explore that challenge.
This is your sixth solo album, and you know, how would you compare being a solo artist where you're the band leader versus sort of being in a collective with your siblings?
Well, that was a huge jump for me, which I had to. It was a hurdle for me I had to face when I went from being in the rankings to going solo. That was about 13, 14 years ago. And, you know, when you have other band members, especially siblings, you have opinions that you trust and people to bounce ideas off. And basically it's a team of people that are on the same, you're on the same team. And so when I solo, I didn't have that. I don't have that. And making a record, you have to learn how to make decisions yourself without having that sort of safety net or of people to tell you, well, this is good, this is bad, you know, this shouldn't do this. And you're relying on yourself and your producer. And,
yeah.
And also going out and touring as well, delivering a two-hour show by myself vocally was a challenge for me. It's something I'd never really done, you know, in front of a live audience. I'd always been one of four singers and then having instrumentals. So it wasn't a vocally challenging night for me when I was with my siblings. I did harmonies, but four or five songs a night is not a lot of... But then you, as a solo artist, you have to sing, you know, anywhere between 18, 20 songs, you know, depending on how long your night is, and do that night after night and stay healthy and have a voice and not strain your voice and take care of yourself and all that. So that's challenging. And then learning how to be a band leader, where it's basically you're the front guy, going from being sort of a front side guy to being the front guy. But I knew I could do it. I've been in bands and around music all my life. It was just a matter of doing it.
How would you describe your writing process? Would it be any different, you know, from back when you were with your siblings?
Well, subject matter with my siblings back in those days, I was really, I think we're all trying to really, you know, especially those first two or three records of the Rankins, we were really trying to present music and songs that really came from where we were coming from. Trying to, the subject matter of the original songs and the fiddle music and all of that was really where we were coming from. And over the years, you know, you travel more and you're around different people. And so as a writer, I'm always basically, you know, keeping my mind open for ideas. And I write about whatever is around me. And but the process is pretty much the same. You know, I like to have a quiet space and ideas come to you in the middle of the night or late night. And you try to chase them and follow them, you know, chase them down, follow them, and write them down and finish them. And the song is like a puzzle sometimes. And these days I'm doing a lot of co-writing with people, and so I find that's a lot of fun. I'm working with people who have a great pop sensibility or country sensibility, so I really enjoy the collaboration. I've always enjoyed collaboration, but you know, in the songwriting way, I'm enjoying that a lot more these days.
You mentioned where you come from, and Nova Scotia, and in particular Cape Breton, it just seems to be a haven for musical output. What is the sense of community and culture in that area that breeds so much awesome, great music?
I'm from a Scottish-Irish background, and always been a strong sense of tradition, musically and history, you know, people talking about their ancestors. You know, storytelling is a big part of that culture. And I grew out of that, you know, and my songs are story songs. A lot of them, you know, are really about, could have been the dance the other night, or about somebody who, you know, somebody from another life that I've never even known, you know, that I've heard about through my grandmother or, you know, whatever. But it's really hard to describe that place. There's just a strong sense of tradition there, but also a very deep music well of Celtic music there. And it's been passed on, and they came over from you know, the British Isles, Ireland and Scotland, and it's evolved into its own thing there. And I think this Celtic music is stronger than ever there. There's tons of young fiddlers and piano players, and it's a very unique music. It's unique from what is known as Scottish or Irish music now. It's Cape Breton's is its own entity, its own genre of music, Cape Breton fiddle music. And also what I've seen in the past 25 years are a lot of kids are coming out of there writing songs now. And there were writers there when I was growing up, but not a lot in my, where I'm from, and I think I was one of a handful of people that were writing songs. But I've noticed a lot of kids with guitars and singing now, which is really wonderful to see.
Yeah. I know you move down to Nashville, and what does it mean for you coming back up and touring Canada?
Well, I moved to Nashville just to be around music. You know, Nashville's sort of the only real music mecca in the world, where people come from all over the world, and you know, for the bag of songs and the guitar, and there's everything there. It's not just country music. There's thousands of songwriters and mandolin players and rock bands and everything there. It's very inspiring. You can go out any night of the week and hear a different style of music in a different band. And that's, I wanted to be around that, you know, a place where you go to the coffee shop to get a coffee and you bump into somebody who's written good songs, you know. So that's very inspiring for me. But coming back to Canada, I come back here to work. Ironically, when I moved to Nashville, I released a record while I was there in Canada, and it just put me on the road. I've always been working here, but I just started really working a lot more, and it had been 4 years in between records, so I really wanted to rebuild my solo career. And so that's three records ago. I put out it was called Forget About the World, and I released a Christmas record with a bunch of original songs on it. And now this one, Back Road Paradise, so I'm out touring it.
And you have Alison Krauss and Jim Cuddy on this album.
Yeah.
How did that come about?
Well, Jim, you know, I've known Jim for many years, bumping into each other at festivals, and we've shared stages together. I had this song called Never Gonna Leave, which is very much an Everly Brothers era sounding song, and I wanted a really strong, singular voice to sing on it, and I was thinking about who, and Jim's name came up, and it was like perfect, and because that's just right up his alley, that style of music. So I just called Jim and sent him the song, and you know, he loved it and sang on it, and of course he's great, so we sound really good together. You never know what you're going to sound like with somebody if you haven't sung with them. And actually Greg Keeler sang on my first solo record, a song called Follow to Around. He's got Cape Breton roots. And Alison, I did a songwriting thing with her in Nashville last year. And we just stayed in touch and sent her a couple of songs, and she loved them, and asked her if she'd sing on them, and she very generously sang on them, and she sounds amazingly, hauntingly beautiful. So, yeah, it's great. I mean, I really appreciate the fact that people who have very busy lives and schedules take the time out of their day to learn my music and sing on it. So, and I don't think if they didn't like the song, they wouldn't sing on it. So, great. So, I'm thrilled. Great, it was perfect. It's just, throughout the process of making a record, I'm constantly thinking about having a guest musician, especially as the record, I near the end of it. I'm thinking about who I'd like to have guest on it, whether it's a instrumental or vocal. And for instance, last record I had Keith Urban, he played a solo on a single I had, and another thing. And I'd worked with him over the years a couple of times. I'd toured with him and been on the same stage and bump into him in Nashville. And I texted him and sent him the song and took the time out of his busy schedule to come in and lay down a blistering solo.
Now, I know you have a milestone birthday coming up. You know, over your past, 25, 30 years or so in music, has there been a favorite memory or you know, from either, from your shows or making an album that really stands out for you?
I've been making records for 25 years, and the whole industry has changed, but basically there are different ways to make records. I've really had a great career in that. I've worked with incredible people in the studio and on stage, and I've had like tons of memories of people I've worked with and met. I mean, having Alison Krauss come in and sing on my record is pretty amazing, and Jim Cuddy, so just be able to call these people and say, "Listen, you want to sing? Yeah, send me the song." And then have that magic. So. I don't know. That's my favorite memory, really. It's my most recent. But I've met so many people and worked with great people.
And would you say you have a favorite track off Back Road Paradise?
I think every song is a terrific song. I don't like putting duds on a record. But I have to say that my track with Jim, I'm Never Gonna Leave, just that it's got that sort of it's up-tempo, kind of really nailed that song. And the one with Allison is a beautiful song, Flames, and I do both in my show. So.
All right. Well, Jimmy Rankin, thanks so much, man.
Awesome, dude. Great to
talk
to you.
And that was Jimmy Rankin. His album is Back Road Paradise. And this is Endeavors on CJSF 90.1 FM Burnaby. We have a couple of announcements, and then you're going to hear my chat with Isadora Kosofsky. All right. Last week, I had the privilege of speaking with documentary photographer Isadora Kosofsky.
On the phone with me now is photographer Isadora Kosofsky. Isadora, welcome to the show. Thanks.
Thank you very much for having me.
So you're what's known as... what I've read about you is that you're a documentary photographer. But I've also read that you haven't actually been photography for that long. Do you remember when and why you first picked up a camera?
When I was about 9, my grandma and I watched Antonioni, who's an Italian filmmaker, one of his films entitled Blow Up, which was about a fashion photographer who is unfulfilled photographing models and decides to roam the streets of London, I believe, in search of a meaningful subject. And I was just really drawn at the time to that character. This photographer protagonist thinks that he captured the scene of a murder, but returns later to find out that it didn't happen. And in retrospect, I think I was emotionally drawn to the character's search for truth within an illusion. So I always kind of, I think subconsciously, had the idea of wanting to be a photographer or wanting to photograph, but it wasn't until after my grandma passed away when I was 13 that I asked my family for a camera and used photography as a way to alleviate loneliness after her passing, because we were very close.
Do you think it's because of that relationship that you had with your grandmother that a lot of your series and shots focus on seniors?
I think so. I think the closeness that I had with my grandmother was definitely an inspiration, but I relate to seniors. I relate to their sense of paradoxical loss and liberation that comes with aging. But I started out not necessarily wanting to do a body of work about seniors. It's just coincidentally that I was attracted to photographing their lives and the relationships that I formed with certain people turned into multiple series.
I noticed a lot of your subjects, particularly both the three and this existence, seem to be about some form of love and relationships. Do you recall what attracted you to those specific subjects?
Well, in terms of the three and this existence, the three is about a relationship between three seniors. It's technically, in the various publications, it's been deemed a love triangle, so it's a relationship between two women and a man. And this existence is about the relationship, the marriage between two people, Adam and Rosie, and shadows Rosie's illness and eventual death, and Adam and Rosie have a 20-plus year age difference. So both projects reveal the lives of individuals who would be deemed somewhat unconventional, or their relationships would be deemed somewhat unconventional. But I think that I photograph love and relationships because they have been the two main struggles of my young life. So I photograph what I know, but also what I try to understand about myself.
What do you think your subjects have taught you about yourself, or how have they altered your view of the world?
Well, my close bonds, the close bonds that I form with those I photograph, allow them to be vulnerable, but that connection also allows me to be vulnerable. Particularly, my subjects have taught me to embrace my fragility and sensitivity as attributes rather than disadvantages. I've never felt like I fit into a particular group, but when I'm with my subjects, I feel included.
Okay.
And I don't necessarily consider the people I photograph as my subjects. All of my projects are long-term endeavors. So eventually the people I photograph become like friends.
Talk about like what goes in when you actually set up a shot. How long does it take you to sort of set up one shot?
Well, none of my work is posed. It's all spontaneous. So I take a fly on the wall, so to speak, approach to image making, and I try to be as unobtrusive as possible. And the close bond that I form with each of my subjects allows them to eventually forget my presence. So I take an immersive approach to each documentary project, and I like to feel like I'm a part of the group, and also am some detached in the sense that I am not intervening in anything that's occurring. I'm an observer, and I capture images spontaneously in the moment, and I feel conveys the narrative of the individuals that I'm photographing.
A lot of your photos have a ton of emotion in them. Was it a conscious decision for you to capture the emotion of your subjects, or did that just come about simply because of who your subjects were?
Well, I want my documentary form to be an emotional visual language. Like I said, I become very involved with my subjects so that they trust and feel comfortable with my presence. I'm drawn to people who feel excluded or ignored, and I'm drawn to people who are in emotional conflict with themselves or those around them. So I would say, in terms of the emotional construction of a narrative, it's partly the reason I'm drawn to certain people is because I relate to the emotions and I want to translate those emotions visually. And then also the creative process or the closeness that I have with them allows them to feel comfortable enough to reveal that vulnerability in front of the camera.
Do you find yourself keeping in touch with many of the people you photograph after your documentary series on them is concluded?
Yeah, I definitely feel like none of my projects are over per se. You know, when a project is published, it doesn't necessarily mean that the project is over. It just means that a section from that project is exposed, but it doesn't necessarily mean that that series has culminated. So, yes, absolutely. I mean, everybody that I've photographed, I'm still in contact with and see them regularly. There's a woman that I've been photographing since I was 14 named Bianca, so that I'm 20 years old now. So it's about a six-year relationship. And absolutely, as in terms of this existence, that project, I guess I could say, has ended because Rosie did pass away and she was the focus of the project. But I consider all of my projects to be ongoing because as the narrative changes, I'm still drawn to document the story.
Now, you've been doing photography for about 6 or 7 years now, and we've seen a lot of developments in technology. How has sort of that, you know, science and tech advancement affected your work in any way, if it has, would you say?
Well, in terms of the type of photography that I do, which falls under the photojournalistic and documentary category, I would say that documentary photographers tend to use digital technology now because of the nature of the medium, and particularly for those, you know, working on time-sensitive projects, it is easier to use digital. And I personally use digital. I did start out using film originally. When I first started photographing the elderly in convalescent hospitals, retirement homes, and in the community at large, I was using film. But because of transitions, I've sort of adapted to the new technologies. Like, I'm even doing video work now. None of my multimedia has been shown yet, but I'm trying to transition and adapt to the needs of a modern audience. And I do that not necessarily for aesthetic reasons, but I want people to view the story, as many people as possible, because those that I photograph, that I try to represent in my images, I want as many people as possible to relate to them and to see their story. So I adapt in terms of what I feel my audience wants.
So, you know, and on that note, social media was kind of just at the tip when you first started photography, and now it's everywhere. How is social media for you as an outlet of getting work out there?
I think social media is great. Because it allows people who don't necessarily buy a magazine, go to a museum or a gallery to see my work. So it adds a tremendous amount of diversity to my audience, and I'm very happy about that. So I've seen a lot of responses from young people, middle-aged people, older people from different backgrounds through social media. And, you know, it's very moving to see somebody tweet a comment, you know, about a project because they related or identified to the people that I photograph. It's very touching, and it's the reason, one of the reasons why I do what I do, is to be able to alleviate the loneliness that some people might feel through the use of photography as a way to make people feel less alone. So to see the responses through social media, it's definitely very fulfilling, and I'm really happy to see the diversity that comes about through the use of social media and how we are able to make documentary more accessible to the international community and less exclusive to certain communities.
It's great work. You can visit Isadora at isadorakosofsky.com. That's isadorakosofsky.com. It's really intriguing work. I look forward to more from her in the future. Isadora, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Alrighty, cheers.
And that was Isadora Kosofsky, and once again, you can reach her at isadorakosofsky.com. And this has been Endeavors on CGSF 90.1 FM. Burnaby, my thanks to Isadora Kosofsky, my thanks to Jesse Perrant, my thanks to Jimmy Rankin. My show next week will be Yan Ju from the EFF and author Miriam Tape. Stay tuned for Strep Throat Radio. We're going to take you out with Jimmy Rankin featuring Jim Cuddy, Never Gonna Leave. We'll see you next week. Bye, everybody. Bye. Say you'll never